He believed that art was essentially the impulse to preserve, the desire to stay those unstaying feet, if only for a moment. In this poem, he is lacerated by time as he looks at an old photograph of a girlfriend. Those flowers, that gate, these misty parks and motors lacerate simply by being over. You contract my heart by looking out of date. But poets are not the only writers waving the train out of the station. Novelists do it as well, and so do playwrights. One of the best of them is Alan Bennett, the champion valedictorian of my generation. And like me, he's been doing it all his life. Here's a passage from a recent diary. That so much of what I've written has been in the valedictory mode ought to make these latter days seem nothing new. I was saying farewell to the world virtually in my teens, and my first play, when I was aged 34, was a lament for an England that is gone. My last play, aged 79, was still waving the same handkerchief. While it is true that artists possess the capacity for recovering and reliving the past to an unusual degree, it is something most of us do. Even if we don't hunt for antiques or collect old books, the chances are that we've held on to a lot of detritus from our own past. I still have my school certificate from 1950, only a pass in Greek, I notice, and photographs from my 2 years national service in the army. Photographs. Larkin was right. Nothing lacerates the heart more than poring by lamplight over old photograph albums. And we turn up at reunions amazed at the changes time has wrought in people we haven't seen for decades, thickened waists and vanished hairlines. Then we attend memorial services to hear dead friends summoned to life for an hour before the church door closes on them forever. We mourn the way time steals everything from us. It takes away our youth, then those we love. Last of all, it comes for us. So it's hardly surprising that it is the main subject of all human art. It is also religion's great passion. After a life spent wrestling with it, I have learned to understand and use religion also as a human art, the work of an imagination obsessed with time and death. But a big difference between religion and the other arts is that it not only observes and mourns the passing of time, it challenges and defies it in two ways. It defies the finality of individual death, and it refuses the idea that the universe itself may in time die back into emptiness. Let me remember my way back into both these claims. I found the lines pasted onto the fridge door of a recently widowed friend and have loved them ever since and thought about them often. It was obvious what they meant to her. She longed for the front door to open and for her husband to come in from the school he taught in, drop his bag on the floor and go to the fridge. What a day. I need a beer. Sometimes she imagined it had happened, and she'd look up eagerly, expecting his entrance. Once or twice she thought she'd seen him in the street ahead of her, but as he turned at her call, it was a stranger. She knew there was no way back, but she could not stop scenes from the dear dead past spooning in her mind. No wonder she'd stuck that fragment of verse onto the fridge door. If I could turn upon my finger the bright ring of time, the now of then I would bring back again. But for some who mourn a death, it is not a question of bringing back the now of then. For them it has never gone away. That's when the clock stopped and time stood still. I had a parishioner who kept the easy chair exactly where it was when her husband died in it. He'd been smoking his pipe when he began to feel unwell. so he put it, half-smoked, into the ashtray on the table beside the chair and died. And 20 years later, it was still there, a dried-up plug of old tobacco in it just as he had left it. That was when the hands on the clock stopped moving for her. She wasn't morbid or weepy about it, but nothing had mattered to her since her husband's death. I doubt if she knew it, but she might have been reciting from one of W. H. Auden's poems. He was my north, my south, my east and west, my working week and my Sunday rest, my noon, my midnight, my talk, my song. I thought that love would last forever. I was wrong. The stars are not wanted now. Put out every one. Pack up the moon and dismantle the sun. Pour away the ocean and sweep up the wood, for nothing now can ever come to any good. If losing the man you've been married to for a lifetime is devastating, the death of a child you've only had for a few years can be worse. Every instinct protests against carrying our own children to the grave. It's a rent in the fabric, a break in the order, a terrible contradiction. No wonder the parent longs to change places with the child in the grave. That's how King David of Israel felt when he heard his rebellious son Absalom had been killed. And the king was much moved, and went up to the chamber over the gate, and wept. And as he wept, thus he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son. Religion is at its best, and can be at its worst when ministering at the death of children, probably because it is caught between the longing to comfort and the compulsion to explain or reconcile such a tragedy. Sometimes the way it comforts implies an explanation our minds find hard to accept. As a doubting priest, that's a contradiction I learned to live with and no longer seek to be rescued from, the best and the worst of religion. And it is the death of children that brings it most clearly into focus. The first funeral of a child I conducted was in February 1960, but I can remember it as if it were yesterday, and not just because I blundered. I hadn't known the couple for long when their 2-year-old son died. I went with them to a village outside Lanark to bury him in a tiny cemetery on the slope of a hill streaked with snow. The young father insisted on carrying the little white coffin himself, clutching it fiercely as we trudged to the hole the gravediggers had dug for his son. I read from the prayer book service for the burial of a child. Man that is born of a woman hath but a short time to live and is full of misery. He cometh up and is cut down like a flower. He fleeth as it were a shadow and never continueth in one stay. Truth, but not much comfort there. When it was over, I put my arm around the mother's shoulders and whispered a hope the pain would pass. She shoved me away roughly. I want to feel the pain, she cried. How should I not feel the pain for the death of my wee boy? And I want to feel it forever. Religion's first instinct in the face of death is to try to console like that, however awkwardly, and it's a particularly strong impulse at the death of a child. Harder than consoling the parents is what to say to a child that knows it is dying. Here the instinct to comfort and reassure is even more overwhelming. It has even been argued that we invented God in order to guarantee or support our longing for life after death. The only consolation we can offer a dying child is that death is not the end, it's the entrance to another life. And since nothing on earth can support or justify that claim, we are forced to put forward the idea of God to guarantee it. But that's not the right way to put it either. In the moment of encounter with the dying child, theory vanishes, as well as the doubts that must accompany all theory. Facing down this nothingness, the priest is even absent from his own doubts and failures. They are not present because they are irrelevant to the extremity of the situation. The priest is emptied of everything except defiance in the face of absolute loss, and becomes, in Auden's phrase, a way of happening, a mouth. And the word the mouth utters is no, even if it is shouted into a void. When I laid my hands gently on the heads of the dying and prayed the presence of a loving God into their minds, in that moment the truth or untruth of my action did not matter. The act contained its own meaning. The act was its own meaning. Everything else disappeared except the need to comfort the one afraid to fall into nothing. It was only when the consolation was over that the question of its meaning arose. Looking back, I can see how that dialectic has always been at work in my own experience. When I was a curate in Glasgow, I became close to the family of an 11-year-old girl who was dying of leukemia. What do you say to a child who knows she hasn't long to live and is afraid, especially of being taken away from her parents? Apart from being there and offering love and support, hands laid gently on heads and silence, religion also offers God as a future in which the separated will be brought together again. If God is the ultimate reality on whom everything else is dependent or contingent, it follows that in God nothing is ever lost. It is even possible to deal with the difficulty of time for a child's mind. Her parents are young and will live long after she is dead. Will they forget her? But doesn't she see that in God there is no time or change? God is an eternal now. Do you remember times when you were so enthralled by a movie or a book that time stood still for you? It'll be like that. All the pains of separation that time and space impose on us in this life will be resolved in an eternal here and now. Did I believe it? That's the wrong question, though I might not have known it at the time. There was no room for anything else by that bedside, though it was years before I found a way of understanding it. It came to me through one of the greatest books of the 20th century, The Last of the Just, by André Schwarzbart, a novel about the Holocaust. At the end of the novel, it is 1943, and Ernie Levy with his girlfriend Golda and a band of children he has been protecting are on one of the death trains to Auschwitz. One of the children has just died. Ernie said, clearly and emphatically, so that there would be no mistaking him, "He's asleep." Then he picked up the child's corpse and with infinite gentleness laid it on the growing heap of Jewish men, Jewish women, Jewish children, joggled in their last sleep by the jolting of the train. "He was my brother," a little girl said hesitantly, anxiously, as though she had not decided what attitude it would be best to take in front of Ernie. He sat down next to her and set her on his knees. "He'll wake up too, in a little while, with all the others when we reach the kingdom of Israel. There children can find their parents and everybody is happy, because the country we're going to, that's our kingdom, you know. There," a child interrupted happily, repeating the words rhythmically, as though he had already said or thought or heard them several times, "there we'll be able to get warm day and night." "Yes," Ernie nodded. That is how it will be. There, said a second voice in the gloom, there are no Germans or railway trucks or anything that hurts. A woman digs her fingernails into Ernie's shoulder. How can you tell them it's only a dream? She breathed with hate in her voice. Rocking the child mechanically, Ernie gave way to dry sobs. Madam, he said at last, there is no room for truth here. In a public conversation with Richard Dawkins at the Edinburgh Science Festival some years ago, I quoted those words and asked him what he would have done in the situation. The same, he said. It turns out that there are times when it is impossible to accept the utter finality of death. A child's death is one of them. There is no room for truth here. There is only room for the impossible act of consolation. But religion does more than console us in the face of death. It uses its best arts to defy death itself and withstand its power over us. And music is its loudest trumpet. A few years ago, I was at a friend's solemn requiem mass. The setting for the mass was for baritone soloist by the French composer Durufle. My friend lay in his coffin in the chancel, and my sadness was eased when the young baritone solo sang Hosanna, Save Us, again and again over his dead body. I heard it as a protest against the finality of death. Death was a brute power, and it had beaten my friend to the ground. But the beauty of the music defying his death was itself a kind of victory. It reminded me of that young man years ago in Chinaman Square, waving a handkerchief at the huge tank grinding towards him. Death will roll over us all in the end, but it cannot take away our songs, and they strengthen us in ways words never can. People like me, people of the Word, brought up in a religion of the Word, too easily forget the words can't do everything. We like to believe that everything can be said, that there's a verbal equivalent for every human experience, and really great writers almost put it off. They almost persuade us. Their artistry translates mute emotion into language. Sometimes we shiver with recognition when we read their words, because they come so close to expressing what we ourselves have gone through. But they're not art's only form of translation. Some things just can't be said. That's why Edward Hopper, the great American painter of human loneliness, said that if he'd been able to say it, he would not have had to paint it. That's even more true of music. And it's why what I'm trying to do here is absurd, talking about music instead of playing it. All I can do here is to try to bear witness in a few words to what music can express without any words. As mourners stand in remembrance of their dead at nightfall, what words can convey how a bugle sounding the last post from a castle battlement seems to pour the sorrow of all their loss into the wind? Or how an ancient plain chant melody lifting round a church at evensong carries the same ancient sadness and longing. One of the most remarkable examples of a music that made beauty out of oppression and death is the singing that came from African-American slaves in the United States. Think of the longing and pain in the spirituals and the way they transfigured sorrow into art. One way to connect with their music is through Michael Tippett's oratorio, A Child of Our Time, in which the great spirituals are used like the passion chorales of Bach to capture and transcend human suffering. Steal away home, I ain't got long to stay here. We singers of human sorrow might paraphrase Hopper, if we could say it, we wouldn't have to sing it. But sing it we have, over all the graves of history and against the force that keeps filling them. And we send out our poetry against death as well. Auden told us that poetry makes nothing happen, true, but it can give defiance a mouth, and that's far from nothing. The mouthiest shout of defiance against death comes from St. Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians, the oldest writing in the New Testament, dating from about year 55 of the Common Era, about 25 years after the execution of Jesus Christ. When we first meet Paul, he is a persecutor of those who followed Christ, and it was the word Christ that prompted his wrath. Christos is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word for Messiah, the agent God would send to establish a new kingdom of justice and peace on earth. It was and remains the fundamental hope of the Jewish people, and not just of the Jews. It is also one of humanity's most persistent dreams, the establishment of a perfect community in which the strife and inequality that characterize our history will be removed at a stroke, and justice and peace will prevail on earth, and death will be no more. The most vivid versions of that dream came from religious visionaries, but there have been secular versions of the messianic hope, and some of them have darkened the politics of my lifetime. Humans, as reflective animals rarely at peace with themselves, find it hard to live with the muddle and confusion of their nature. So they are always on the lookout for a saviour who will chase all their troubles away. Even the pragmatic and relatively sane political parties of the world's surviving democracies are far from immune to the messianic virus. During periods of accelerating and destructive change, the longing asserts itself again, and we start searching the horizon for the one who is to come. It is a theme well rehearsed in the classic Hollywood Western, such as Shane, in 1953, in which Alan Ladd plays the man from nowhere who rides into a community under threat, destroys the bad guys, and rides away again. In 1985, it was reprised more violently by Clint Eastwood in Pale Rider. The longing persists. We're always on the lookout for the one who will come and save us from ourselves. In Paul's time, there were Jews who thought he had come at last, and the Golden Age was about to be inaugurated. They believed that Jesus of Nazareth was the Messiah, the Christ, hence the name he came to be known by in history, Jesus Christ or Jesus the Messiah. But to their consternation, he did not defeat the powers of the sinful world, he was defeated by them. They executed him on a cross and dumped his body in a criminal's grave. Then his followers described how he appeared to them and told them not to despair. Get ready, he told them. I'll be back soon to bring in the longed for community of righteousness and peace on earth. To Paul, a devout Jew, the claim was blasphemous, and he was commissioned to hunt down those who made it. But while he was on the chase, he himself had an experience that convinced him Jesus was indeed the Christ, the one who was to come. Here's how he describes it. I delivered unto you first of all that which I also received, how that Christ died, and that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day, and that he was seen of Cephas, then of the 12. After that he was seen of above 500 brethren at once. After that he was seen of James, then of all the apostles, and last of all he was seen of me also, the least of the apostles, that am not meet to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. The thing to note is that his psychic encounter with Christ persuaded Paul that Jesus was the Messiah. but it did not persuade him there was life after death. It did not need to, because that was a conviction he already held. Paul was a Pharisee, a member of a sect in Judaism that believed in the resurrection of the dead, a belief that was by no means universal in Judaism then or now. For Paul, Christ's resurrection was not unique. It was a particular example of a general truth: the dead will rise again. In fact, Paul went on to say that if there was no resurrection of the dead, no life after death, then Jesus Christ couldn't have been raised either. Now, if Christ be preached that he rose from the dead, how say some among you that there is no resurrection of the dead? But if there is no resurrection of the dead, then is Christ not risen? And we are found false witnesses of God, because we testified of God that he raised up Christ, whom he raised not up, if so be that the dead rise not. For Paul, what was unique about the resurrection of Christ was that it signaled the beginning of the end of history and its sorrow. Christ's resurrection was the first move in God's end game, and it would be completed in his lifetime. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. Then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? The important phrases in that passage are, We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. Paul is reassuring the followers of Christ that the timetable for God's D-Day is still on, because they were puzzled. They'd been told it would start while all of them were still alive, but it hadn't worked out that way. The trumpet had not sounded, yet some of them had died. Would they miss out on the great day when it came? Paul comforts them. When the trumpet sounds to herald Christ's return, the dead will rise incorruptible from their graves to join in the final victory. It didn't happen. Still hasn't. Like everyone else, believers in Christ keep dying. Yet over their graves the church goes on shouting Paul's defiant questions, O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? And it knows the answers. Hasn't death always been its business? Hasn't it forever watched those graves filling with the dust of its own children? So who can blame it for choosing to confront death not with facts but with poetry? Here's the great poet John Donne. Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think'st thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure, then from thee much more must flow, and soonest are best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and souls delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well, and better than thy stroke. Why swell'st thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death thou shalt die. Religion is at its most compelling when it restrains the urge to explain death away and contents itself with voicing our sorrow and defiance that it keeps beating us into the ground. It feels most authentic when it stops preaching and becomes instead our song, our protest, the handkerchief waved against the immense tank looming at the corner of the street. That's when, in Paul's words, death is swallowed up in victory. But it is only ever the victory of beauty over force. defined by Simone Weil as that X that turns anybody who is subjected to it into a thing. Exercised to the limit, it turns man into a thing in the most literal sense. It makes a corpse of him. Somebody was here, and the next minute, there is nobody here at all. Death gets us all in the end, but it can never kill our songs, and that is the only victory they give us. Here's a poem. You strode up the aisle alone, unafraid of the hushed gloom, stained glass glint from the west on your shoulders, and you paused in the chancel, slim silhouette against the wide east window, child in a field of dwindling light, listening, it seemed, to the silence. What do you think a church is for? I asked, curious as we left. Singing, came your answer, quick and sure, for singing. Religion not only protests the death of the individual, it also protests the death of the universe, the death of all that flowed from the Big Bang of 14 billion years ago. Science offers various scenarios for how that ultimate death will be. Since it is all unimaginably distant in time, 2.8 billion years away according to one reckoning, it's nothing to get worked up about now. As a physical event, it need not trouble us. The universe as we know it will see us out. But that's not the real issue, or not for me. The issue is what it will have meant once it's over. In particular, what it will have meant for us, as far as we know, the only beings in the universe who can think about these matters. Will it all be lost, as if it had never been, like tears and rain? The phrase comes from Ridley Scott's sci-fi movie Blade Runner. Roy is a replicant, played by Rutger Hauer, a humanoid who's been genetically engineered by the Terrell Corporation to be more human than human, but with a lifespan of only 4 years. As Roy feels his powers waning, he looks back on his brief life. I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I've watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time like tears in rain. It is hardly surprising that death should pose questions for us, not only about the meaning of our own life, but about the universe that generated it and in which we spent it. Just as imagining ourselves into the emptiness of death is hard, even harder is to contemplate the absolute emptiness that will follow the death of the universe, the wiping out of everything, including the minds the universe invented to think about itself, all to be lost like tears and rain. It is impossible for some of us not to wonder about this paradox. It is why, after a lifetime of struggle with and frequent feelings of revulsion towards religion, I still think of myself as a religious man. But I now practice religion in a way that passionate protagonists on both sides of the God debate dislike intensely. The frustration I attract reminds me of an incident a few years ago in the debate about gay marriage. Campaigners posted this slogan on the side of London buses, "Some people are gay, get over it." It was aimed at Christian groups who understood human sexuality not as a spectrum of different shades, but as a stark choice between right and wrong, the permitted and the forbidden. Many of us are prone to this kind of binary simplification in moral and theological debate, but it is amplified by those whose favorite discourse is the adversarial. You're either with them or against them. You have to be one thing or the other. There's nothing in between. You certainly can't be both at the same time. This is not only a boring way to look at the world, it's also inaccurate. Nothing is that simple. Louis MacNeice, the poet, nailed it when he said, "World is crazier and more of it than we think, incorrigibly plural." The tragedy is not just the absurdity of trying to purge the world of its crazy variety, but the pain and hurt it causes those who can't or won't force themselves onto our narrow templates. The latest collision between the incorrigible plurality of humanity and the dreary compulsion to split everything in two is in our attitude to gender. We now recognize that, like sexuality, gender is fluid and plural. In some people, it may never be permanently determined, and it might even shift during a single lifetime. Humans are incorrigibly plural. If we've got a problem with that, it's time we got over it. It's also time we realized that the human experience of religion is also various and complex. There are those who are firmly in and those who are firmly out of religious institutions. There are those whose belief is strong and those whose unbelief is equally unyielding. And like the majority of the population whose gender and sexuality are clearly printed, they are the ones who claim to define the territory for the rest of us. But there are as many hues on the religious spectrum as there are on gender and sexuality. We should acknowledge that and come to a more generous and comprehensive understanding of this important aspect of human experience. In the context of the theme of this book, death, there are those for whom religious observance in this life is a way of guaranteeing their status in the next. Their gaze is on the world beyond and how to get there. But for some of us, life after death has little attraction, and we even doubt it exists. It is life before death we concentrate our attention on. We want to make it more just and abundant and joyful for everyone. And some of us find that meditating on religion's best narratives and listening to its wisest teachers and being moved by its music and poetry strengthens us for that work. We don't want to prize others out of their systems of belief or unbelief any more than we want to be boxed into them. Even if we disagree on the best deal after death, why can't we agree on a good deal for everyone before death? Anyway, the gulf between us is not as wide as it may appear. Religions that believe we go on to life after death all say its quality will depend on how we lived before death. Do good in this world, and good will be done unto thee in the next, is the mantra. So whatever the final calculation, this world becomes a better place, exactly what those of us with little interest in eternal life want as well. Everyone wins. But in my experience, if you adopt this dialectical approach to religion, you get caught in the crossfire of its main protagonists. Both the champions and the despisers of religion attack you with equal contempt. It's the binary game all over again. You have to be one thing or the other. You can't be both at the same time or anything in between. Well, tough, some of us are. Get used to it. However, there is more to my attitude to the wars of religion than the desire for a ceasefire to help the wounded. The big question at the center of the conflict troubles me as well, though I cannot resolve it, cannot situate myself permanently at either pole of the discussion. The binary nature of the choice feels forced to my experience. Is this a particularly Scottish tension? Hugh MacDermott certainly thought it marked the Scottish character. In his book on Scottish eccentrics, published in 1936, he talked about the Caledonian anti-Zyzygy, an anti-Zyzygy being the presence of opposing or competing polarities within the same entity. And it has become a cliché in describing our cultural history, Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde being the proverbial example. Wherever the affliction comes from, its main symptom is intense discomfort with any claim to absolute finality in answering the big question the universe poses for us. The theologian Paul Tillich said that being religious meant asking the ultimate question of the meaning of the universe, even if we arrived at an answer that hurt us. An answer that hurts me is that ultimately it means nothing, because there never was anyone there to mean it. It just happened. The riddle is that, without having any meaning itself, the universe generated human creatures with a need for meaning, who then projected meaning onto its speechless blankness. They thought it had spoken to them, had disclosed itself, but it was their own words they were hearing, their own longing they were fulfilling. It was all in the mind, the human mind, the only mind the universe possesses. That is an answer that hurts me, because I think it may be right. It was an answer that also hurt the Spanish philosopher Miguel de Unamuno. In wrestling with the impossible idea of his own non-existence, his own annihilation by death, and the annihilation of the whole universe, he wrote an extraordinary book that is not so much a philosophy or theology of death as a great cry of protest against it, a great nada. He was one of death's deniers, honest enough to admit he needed God in order to guarantee his own immortality. In his book, The Tragic Sense of Life, he quotes from the Italian philosopher Leopardi. A time will come when this universe and nature itself will be extinguished. And just as of the grandest kingdoms and empires of mankind, and the marvelous things achieved therein, very famous in their own time, no vestige or memory remains today, so in like manner, of the entire world, and of the vicissitudes and calamities of all created things, there will remain not a single trace, but a naked silence and a most profound stillness will fill the immensity of space. And so before ever it has been uttered or understood, this admirable and fearful secret of universal existence will be obliterated and lost. That was the possibility that haunted me as I prepared to speak at the funeral of my friend Malcolm. Malcolm had wanted us all to remember him laughing. It was certainly an impossible laugh to forget, a great explosion of merriment and the huge heart it expressed. Even more important to me than his laugh was his smile when you met him. It was a smile of absolute welcome. This was a man who cherished his friends and kept them close, and his smile was a sign that his heart welcomed you in again with delight. That smile was there for his friends to the end, as he lay on the sad height of his deathbed. There was laughter in his dying as in his living, but his had been a hard dying, bravely endured, and it would have been dishonest to ignore it or to try to conceal it. This is what I found myself saying. Malcolm was a fiercely honest man, a man who refused to hide from following truth as he saw it. So we should not hide from this truth either. His was a hard dying. We all owe the universe a death, but not everyone owes it a hard one, and Malcolm certainly didn't. His wife Marion captured its pain in her poem about his last months. Fresh from a family luncheon, short-cutting through the cemetery, he found himself stranded in red-hot pain, unable to move, the first step on a slow journey to a dead end. Losses piled up unannounced, huge and mean. Promises of better times flickered and flared. Each treatment stole vigor from limbs and life. The triple bypass now beat mercilessly, and hope seeped from our hearts. We learned to live with the downward path, to be grateful for freedom by buggy. for the jab that distanced the pain even while holding on to the agony. We learn to be thankful for being shielded for so long from the knowledge that it could be like this at the end. And sometimes our hearts shone as they bled, and we were thankful for that too. So Malcolm's dying forces a question from us. How are we to find meaning in the agony of such a good and life-enhancing man? Christian faith has its confident answer, and those of us within the Christian tradition are familiar with its claims and their power to console, even if, like Malcolm, we have come to doubt them and the confidence with which they are proclaimed. But if we hold to the old consolations and believe that all should be well in the end, all wrongs ultimately righted and tears wiped from every eye, there is still a difficulty in explaining how in the meantime the Creator has ended up making us traverse a universe so steeped in pain and loss and so packed with grief. We may believe things will come right in the long run, but what is there to say about the short run? In particular, what is there to say about the meaning of this man's life and his hard dying? I can think of three things to say at a time like this. First, even if the universe is ultimately without meaning, and even if we dismiss religion's consolation, in the words of the poet Philip Larkin, as that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die, we are left with a paradox that amidst the tumults and plagues and cruelties of existence, the universe has also given birth to love and laughter, both of them strongly embodied in the life of the man we mourn and celebrate today. I don't want to push the claim too far, but is there not something unexpectedly gracious about a universe that can prompt a strong, confident, creative man like Malcolm to turn from the making of board games at which he was a celebrated artist and turn himself into an internationally respected cartographer of the strange land of dementia and a sympathetic guide through the dark valley of aging? My second point follows from that. Even if the universe ultimately means nothing and comes to nothing, even if we agree with the philosopher Leopardi that a time will come when this universe and nature itself will be extinguished, and this admirable and fearful secret of universal existence will be obliterated and lost, even if that is to be the final truth of existence itself, I believe we can say that a life like Malcolm's was its own meaning and justification, if only as an act of defiance of the void that awaits us all. Even if it all comes to nothing, this man's life, this confident, creative, compassionate life, has brought meaning out of the abyss, and in celebrating it today, we will not let it go to waste. It is right to mourn Malcolm's death and to cry at losing one we loved so much. But we should also let his joyful living and brave dying strengthen us in our own struggle to live well, and when our own time comes to die as bravely as he did. Go from us, good friend. You have strengthened us for the struggle, and your laughter we will never forget. As I left the pulpit, the thought of the void giving birth to a life as generous as Malcolm's and then deleting it continued to trouble me. Even if Leopardi is right and the experiment of being was empty of meaning from the beginning, and even if the universe is destined to be sucked back into the nothingness it came from and be succeeded by a naked silence and a profound stillness, then we will have proved ourselves better than the void that spawned us, because of what we ourselves created, great music, torrents of it, poured out down the centuries, great words, rivers of them, all trying to express the mystery of our own existence, paintings that captured its loneliness and grandeur, and acts of loving kindness that defied the sneer of the abyss that swallowed them. And isn't it strange that such beauty and purpose came from such emptiness? So why be shocked when some of us find ourselves answering the question of the ultimate meaning with a no and a yes in the same breath and at the same time? That's the antizygy in which some of us find ourselves. And yes, it hurts. It's the pain that comes with being human. That's why Unamuno advised us that even if it is nothingness that awaits us and the universe, we humans should so live that it will be an unjust fate. 6. The Day After. The American philosopher Arthur Danto described the human animal in a Latin phrase as an ens representans, a being that represents the world back to itself, a being that mirrors being. And we can't help doing it. Give children crayons and a sheet of paper, and they'll draw mummy and daddy and the cat on the mat before the fireplace. Listen to people on the bus going home from work, and they'll be telling their day over again to their friends. All human art flows from this compulsion to represent or describe or make over again all the worlds we experience. And the best artists do it to a miraculous degree. We say of them what Samuel Beckett said of the writings of James Joyce: they were not about the thing, they were the thing itself. Great art does not tell or talk about its subject, it shows it, makes it present. It is all part of the human passion to preserve at least the memory of the past before it hurtles into oblivion. Writers do it, photographers do it, and so do painters. This is how John Berger described their purpose. The portraitist contests the mortality of his sitter. The landscape painter contests the ceaseless movement of nature. The history painter, the forgetting of history. And the still life painter, the dispersal of objects. His antagonists are decay, the bailiff, and the junk merchant. Religion does it too. At his Last Supper with his disciples, the night before he died, Jesus blessed bread and wine and gave it to his companions at table in these words from their Greek translation in the Gospels: Tuto poieti istein amen anamnesen. Do this in remembrance of me. In that quotation, the Greek word anamnesen is worth thinking about. It's translated as remembrance, a word that has lost some of the power of the original. To us, remembering suggests the backward look. We sit under the lamp with the photograph album and see ourselves as we were and others who are no longer with us. But sometimes the experience does not feel like a backwards glance, a look over the shoulder. Through the chemistry of longing, someone from the past comes alive to us again. We imagine them in the street ahead of us and have to halt ourselves from crying out. We catch ourselves saying, "Wait till I tell her this," forgetting for a moment that she's gone forever. That's why people take part in seances with psychics who claim to be able to make contact with the dead. Raising the dead is an ancient art, and even the Bible, which disapproves of the practice, contains accounts of it. In one of them, King Saul, perplexed about the challenges that face him as leader of Israel, tries to summon up his old adviser Samuel to help him. Then Saul said to his servant, "Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servant said to him, "Behold, there is a medium at Endor." So Saul disguised himself and put on other garments and went, he and two men with him. And they came to the woman by night. And he said, divine for me by a spirit, and bring up for me whomever I shall name to you. The woman said to him, surely you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the wizards from the land. Why then are you laying a snare for my life to bring about my death? But Saul swore to her by the Lord, as the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. Then the woman said, whom shall I bring up for you? He said, bring up Samuel for me. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice, and the woman said to Saul, why have you deceived me? You are Saul. The king said to her, have no fear. What do you see? And the woman said to Saul, I see a God coming up out of the earth. He said to her, what is his appearance? And she said, an old man is coming up, and he is wrapped in a robe. And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and did obeisance. Though attempts to summon or use the dead in this way have been banned by many religions, they have rarely been consistent in their disapproval. We have already seen that in Catholic doctrine the prayers of the living were believed to assist the dead on their way through purgatory. The reverse was also true. It was thought that the prayers of the dead could assist those still alive on earth. Because it was believed that those holy souls who had entered heaven at death were now in a position to petition God on behalf of the living, much the way a favoured courtier might persuade a monarch to promote a friend. Intercessory prayer of this sort became specialised, and it was believed that individual saints had particular skills when it came to aiding human need. Going on a journey? Get the protection of the saint who looked after travellers. Lost a precious possession? Go to the saint for lost property. Cannot beget a child? There was a saint whose intercession could help with that. It wasn't exactly what is now called spiritualism, the belief that the living can be in direct contact with the dead, but it wasn't that far from it either. In the middle of the 19th century, the spiritualist movement in the United States formed itself into an organized denomination. Spiritualists believed that the souls of the dead were located on an etheric plane parallel to the physical universe, which was accessible to psychics like the one Saul consulted at Endor. A spiritualist service was a séance enfolded within a liturgy. There would be prayers and readings, as in a conventional act of worship, but the real focus was on communication with the dead. Around the same time in Victorian England, some prominent members of society became interested in spiritualism for scientific reasons. They formed the Society for Psychical Research to examine paranormal phenomena to see if it could prove the existence of life beyond the grave. The method they adopted to gather proof of life on the other side was a system of automatic or spiritual writing called cross correspondence. The idea was that when members of the Society for Psychical Research died, they would use spirit writing to get back in touch with those still alive, and in this way they could cross-check any claims made. The philosopher John Gray said all their carefully designed experiments achieved was a reflection of their own subconscious longings. It turned out that the afterworld was very like the one these Victorian researchers had left behind, and dying was like moving from one wing of a great English country house to another. The slaughter of the Great War gave added impetus to the spiritualist movement in both its ecclesiastical and scientific modes. Most cities in the West will have at least one spiritualist church. There are still some universities with departments that do research into the paranormal. And famous mediums still pack out theatres with their public seances and demonstrations of psychic power. Whatever we make of all of this, it shows that in human experience the dead fascinate the living. One way or another, they continue to